Welcome to Situational Awareness Tactics Podcast. This podcast provides the crucial art of understanding current elements in an environment to increase your safety and survival. Here's your host, forensic psychologist and consultant, Dr. Carlos.
Welcome, everyone. Well, today I have a very special guest. Her name is Alyssa Knight. She calls herself a recovered hacker. I like that title. AlyssaKnight.com is where you can find her. You can also find her at KnightInkMedia.com. It's Knight, K-N-I-G-H-T, Inc, I-N-K, Media.com. We're going to be talking about her book, Hacking Connected Cars. If it scares you as much as me, then you should listen to this podcast. Before we get started, make sure to share, subscribe, and hit that like button. We truly appreciate it. So let's not waste any more time. And welcome to the show, Ms. Alyssa Knight. Welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Carlos.
Thank you for being here. This is really a fascinating and scary topic all at the same time. Tell us a little bit about what motivated you to write this book.
Yeah, so I had lived in Stuttgart, Germany for a while, hacking connected cars, working with some of the tier one OEMs and large automakers in the area in the Stuttgart corridor, and just garnered a lot of boots on the ground experience in hacking cars, specifically through their telematics control units, or what's really basically the router for the car, and the infotainment system or head unit in the car. So I wanted to take all of that knowledge over the years that I had collected in these different engagements and turned it into a book. There's a lack of researchers specifically around vulnerabilities in connected cars, especially attacking cars remotely. So you have quite a few researchers who specialize in hacking cars through the CAN bus, through inside the car or the OBD2 port. I like to focus on hacking cars remotely. So what can I do from my living room? What can I do with that car? Take remote control of it, move the steering wheel, press the brakes, press the gas, versus what I can do inside the car. I feel like once you're inside the car, game is over anyway.
I would assume so. Now, some people are probably going to be saying, well, wait a minute. This is stuff you see on Mission Impossible, Tom Cruise. I mean, is it real? Is it just once in a lifetime? How easy is it to actually do this?
Yeah, you know, it's definitely a labyrinthine area of vulnerability research. It's not like you can throw a rock and hit a penetration tester that can hack IIS or Apache web servers and be able to start hacking embedded systems inside a car, what are called electronic control units. So it is definitely a study that requires not just exposure to the components and the ability to test them, but also experience in testing them. You know, hacking an IIS web server is way different than hacking an embedded system. So I would say the answer to your question is it definitely requires a level of sophistication and experience. It's not that no one can't and that it's impossible. I was able to do it. You just need access to the testing systems, the software, some of the more areas of, for example, vehicular mechatronics that you would have access to.
I guess it also makes me wonder, we've seen this exponential growth in ability, not just in hacking, but just in technology and how much people learn. And I mean, you know, 10-year-olds know more than I do sometimes about their iPhone. It's just like, well, where did they get this information so fast? Do you think this will develop as well exponentially? People will be able to hack into the cars in about 5 years from now, or is there defense systems catching up?
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of the things have definitely changed over the last 5 to 10 years. You know, you see a lot of the RFPs coming out from the automakers to the OEMs requiring penetration testing, requiring risk assessments. You have ISO 21434 and other standards coming out that focus not just on life and safety, but also cybersecurity, something that was a foreign requirement to automakers and to manufacturers in the automotive space. So I think industry is definitely catching up. The attacks in the wild against connected cars is something that really hasn't been published yet. You haven't really seen anyone, you know, being steered into oncoming traffic because of a hacker. but empirical data and evidence has proven that it's possible. For example, if you look, if you read my book, if you look at some of the videos on my YouTube channel, you can see me taking remote control of vehicles. So recently I published research where I was able to take remote control of federal and state law enforcement vehicles remotely from a hotel room or from my house. So as long as you know the VIN number, some of these vulnerabilities are possible to exploit. And we all know how easy it is to get a VIN number. You can guess them. You can cycle through them. You can walk up to a car in a parking lot and very easily grab the VIN number through the windshield. So it's not exactly the best kept secret in targeting vehicles. So I would say that it's definitely not something we read about or see about, but it is possible. If you go on YouTube, you can see researchers in the past target remote cars, move the steering wheel, push the brakes, push the gas. It's possible. It's just we haven't seen any real attacks, at least of what's been published, actually happen in the wild and end up on the nightly news.
And I might age myself a little bit, but I remember watching Star Trek from many decades ago, and a lot of things back then all of a sudden seemed out of reach. And now here we are with some of those technologies. It's amazing.
Well, you know, so much of what historically was never connected is connected now, right? I mean, even airplanes are connected. I'm working on a project right now, hacking a connected train. I'm working on a project, or we'll be working on a project here soon, starting at the end of this year, on hacking super yachts. So things that were historically not given an IP address for connectivity are now connected. And with that comes an attack surface, because it wasn't an attack surface we had to previously think about, right? If you look at cars and combustible engines, you know, these were things that never had to be thought of. And now we do. We need to think about micro-segmentation within a vehicular network that we never had to consider before. It was all one flat network. Component could talk to component. You didn't need to think about ECU firewalls. You didn't need to think about the fact that there's now a SIM chip in your car and it can communicate over GSM. You know, our cars are computers on wheels. They're cell phones on wheels. You can actually communicate with a car as long as you know how to connect to it, meaning you know how to reach it remotely over GSM. A lot of cars, any car made after 2001 is connected. And they communicate with backend servers and applications, what are called APIs, application programming interfaces. So our cars, you don't have to be driving around in a Tesla to be impervious to, or sorry, to be vulnerable to attack. Anything made after 2001 is connected. So they all communicate with an API server. A lot of the more recent vulnerabilities that I've published and hacks that I've performed were hacking the car through the APIs. Those backend servers for the automaker are hosting and running those API servers, which are able to communicate with the cars.
Well, maybe you'll get a phone call from Elon Musk here soon. You never know. You know, it's interesting. I saw an article, and I don't know if you were written it, you wrote about it, or you were in it. I apologize for that.
Probably all of the above.
Probably. I think it had to do with this. It was Israel. They were doing something with the military cars, and they were guiding.
Yeah, there was a story that was recently published that Israeli, the IDF, Israeli Defense Forces, were considering no longer allowing connected cars to be able to drive onto their military bases. I don't know how easy that would be to enforce. I mean, if you think about it, you would have to leave it up to guards to make a determination whether a car was made after 2001. Whether or not it has 4K cameras on it, whether or not it's connected, you know, how do you do that in just a few seconds or a few minutes? You know, I don't know how enforceable that is. I don't know how realistic that is. You know, it is a concern. I mean, you know, you look at these connected cars these days, they do have 4K cameras. You can do a lot and see a lot more with a car than you could previously. I mean, it's already been published that the automotive industry, I think it was Kathy Woods, who said that the automotive industry wasn't prepared for how fast electronic vehicles electric vehicles would arrive. You know, it wasn't expected to really be in demand or to really have taken over the way it has for another 10 to 15 years. And so it's happening now. And so, you know, we're now trading in combustible engines for batteries, you know, and with EVs and a lot of technology that weren't previously in cars. So they can potentially record audio going on around it that might be on a classified or outside of a classified building. They do have 4K cameras. You can remotely lock and unlock the vehicle or start and stop the engine or, you know, take remote control of the vehicle simply just because you can reach it over the internet.
Yeah, crazy stuff. Folks, Alyssa Knight, K-N-I-G-H-T, if you want to find her YouTube channel, you can see some of those videos that she recommended. You can also find more about her at AlyssaKnight.com. You know, it's interesting. I guess, well, I'm trying to figure out which question I want to ask first. Have you been, you said you worked in which one? I'm sorry?
Ask them all.
Yeah, well, definitely. Germany, you mentioned earlier. Are you seeing anything in Japan or China? We don't always get the news over here about what they're up to in regards to technology, but a lot of times if you visit, they seem to be way ahead of us in a lot of technology. Do you see the same thing with their cars?
Sure, yeah. I mean, you know, you have, for example, Mercedes already advertising its new EQS. Isn't just Tesla, right? Yeah, a lot of the major automakers are announcing new EVs. Audi's got a fully connected EV. Was it GM that announced that they were no longer going to be making traditional vehicles? They're moving to an all EV fleet by, I can't remember what year, 2025 or whatever. But I mean, it's definitely here. It's definitely happening. It's definitely not relegated just to Germany. You have Japanese automakers, you have, even automakers in India, like for example, Tata Motors, who are making connected vehicles, it's definitely not relegated to one particular automaker or country. Here in the United States, American automakers are Ford. You've got the Ford Mustang. What's that new Mustang they're releasing? It's a new fully connected EV Mustang. My wife wants one. I can't remember the name of it, but it's their new Mustang that's going to be coming out or shipping soon. It's definitely everywhere. You can't hide from it. It just because you're not driving around in a Tesla doesn't mean you're not driving around in an attack surface. Everything's connected.
That's a great point. And I'm a little bit, obviously I'm no expert in this field whatsoever. I don't know, obviously, you don't know, but I'm not an expert in this field at all. But I have some friends in the special forces and some friends in whatever they're called. I guess they don't tell you exactly what they're in. But anyway.
They'd have to kill you.
Yeah, exactly, right? They've mentioned things such as black pirate boxes, Raspberry Pis, things of that nature. And when I look at it, they look like these little handheld games. And then they say, well, that's the innocent way of using it. Can you do anything with that in regards to connecting the cars?
Yeah, so with hacking for sure. Raspberry Pis are actually little microcomputers. They literally are about the size of a mouse. They're very small, have an HDMI port. They're fully connected. They have Wi-Fi, Bluetooth interfaces. They're computers, and they can fit in the size of your hand. And so actually quite a few attacks. As a matter of fact, if you go to my YouTube channel, you can see a video of me actually hacking Bluetooth smart locks using Raspberry Pis and called a BLE relay attack. So it is possible. So, you know, the August smart locks that are on people's front doors, a lot of cars are actually installing BLE locks on their doors and in automobiles. So even automakers are adopting BLE, Bluetooth low energy, and those can be hacked through what are called relay attacks. So it is possible. And the interesting thing about Raspberry Pis is it gives you a small form factor to be able to hack from. It gives you a portable capability where, for example, I'm working with law enforcement right now, and we've noodled on the idea of creating these tactical backpacks that are actually powered by Raspberry Pis. So you could walk around anywhere with this tactical backpack and with, for example, creating a rogue base station where you turn your laptop into a cell tower. So one of the ways that you can hack a connected car is to take what's called an SDR, a software-defined radio, like a Blade RF, connect it with a Raspberry Pi and your laptop, and actually don't even need your laptop. You could just use the Raspberry Pi and create what's called a rogue base station or a dirt box. And what it does is it allows you to pretend to be a cell tower. You are broadcasting a signal and local mobile phones, local anything with a SIM chip in it will connect you, thinking you're a cell tower. And what happens if you're in control of that network fabric? What happens if you're a cell tower? You can encrypt, you can decrypt, you can turn off encryption completely and look at the data going in and out of those SMS text messages or even record those phone calls. So anything's possible as long as you control the network. And these Raspberry Pis give you the capability to do that. They're actually really amazing little boxes.
They really are. When these guys were showing me some of the stuff, it's like, wow, you get this little tiny handheld thing. It just makes, I guess one of the things one of the lights went on in my head were the vulnerability everybody has now with that, because you can do a lot of things with those. I mean, they're using it for obviously whatever clandestine missions they have going on, right, and tapping into things. But
actually, Dr. Carlos, just interject.
Okay.
You can actually power these things with batteries. It's really scary.
What kind of battery?
So, you know, those lithium ion batteries that you can hook your laptop up to, your iPhone, your Android to charge it. That same battery can actually power a Raspberry Pi. It's totally insane. So yeah, that's the portable nature of a Raspberry Pi or a lot of these microcomputers is, you know, being able to actually be mobile with it and power it with a battery. It's insane.
Just out of curiosity, I guess, for my own curiosity, maybe somebody out there wants to know too. I've heard of something called a pineapple.
Sure. So pineapple has appeared in multiple movies, multiple TV shows. It was in Mr. Robot. They've used it in a TV show called Silicon Valley, if anyone remembers that. I don't know if it's still in the air or not. But what a pineapple does, it's called a Wi-Fi pineapple. It's actually have one right behind me. You can see that with the antennas. It actually allows you to pretend to be a wireless access point. It does different things. It can act as a client, can act as a wireless access point, but basically it allows you to hack wireless networks. So if I have a pineapple sitting in, for example, Starbucks, I can broadcast with a much stronger signal, the same BSID, as the wireless access point in the area. And the way wireless clients work is they're designed to connect to whatever is projecting the strongest signal. So if you're projecting a really strong signal, your laptop or your mobile phone will automatically switch to that wireless access point because it's projecting a stronger signal and it's broadcasting the correct name. So by doing so, you're capturing those wireless clients and being able to capture their data. So any traffic coming in and out of those nodes, so to speak, you will be able to capture and see and read if it's usernames and passwords, if it's emails. You're in charge of that network fabric again, just like the rogue base station with the cell tower. It works the same way. You can do the same thing with the wireless access point.
Man, that's crazy stuff. Crazy stuff. I guess one of the questions I wanted to ask you too was, what's any big surprises when you were writing your book? Obviously, a lot of the stuff you already knew, but maybe you did some research and found some other things that really surprised you. Anything that really stunned you as you were writing your book, or even in the last year or two?
You know, it's interesting. I really would like to probably start writing a second follow-up book to that first one, because a lot has changed since then. You know, I mean, if you look at how much time was spent into the book, it took me about 2 years to actually write that book. A lot has changed and things were changing as I was writing the book. It's just the crux of working in cybersecurity. Things change every day. But you know, I would say the answer to your question is definitely the prevalence and growth of APIs. We're really in an API first world now. And for those of you who don't know what an API is think of it kind of like a waiter at a restaurant, right? You sit down at your table and you're reading off the menu and you're giving your order to the waiter, who then takes it back into the kitchen and tells the chefs what you want to eat. That's kind of the way an API works. It takes an application, a device, a car, anything, and basically translates those requests, or takes those requests being made from the client and is passing them to the back end in order to request that data you're requesting. So, you know, mobile apps use it, connected cars use it, all of these IoT devices and applications talk to APIs. As a matter of fact, Akamai just recently released a report saying that it was like 86% of the traffic flowing across the internet through the CDN is actually API traffic now. So The scary thing is that means that human to application traffic is no longer a majority of the traffic on the internet today. It's application to application traffic on the internet. And it makes it more than a majority of the CDN traffic across Akamai. So it's incredibly scary. So if you look at just the way things are moving, our financial services are being powered by APIs, cars, all of these things are communicating with APIs, and hackers know it. And so they're turning their attention to APIs. So I think that the biggest change, or the most shocking thing for me during and after that book, is just the prevalence and growth of APIs and our need as defenders to switch our focus to APIs, because that's where the next battlefront is going to be. That's where it is now. It's already happening.
Yeah, that is scary. Amazing stuff. Again, folks, the book is called Hacking Connected Cars. Alyssa Knight, KNIGHT.com is where you want to go to learn more about it. Really, you're really motivating me to go back to the old muscle cars, Alyssa.
1960s Mustang.
There you go. Maybe you can get your wife that instead.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding.
Probably worth the same, though, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. Now, you said you did it from the hotel, where you were able to hack a car. So how is there a distance limitation? I guess I'm hoping.
No, and that's the neat thing. And that's where I really like to focus the area of my research, is what can you do remotely? Because that's what I care about the most, is the adversary that can do things from the comfort of anywhere. So there is no distance limitation. As long as you can connect to the internet, you can communicate with these APIs. And that's really what it's about. Like, a lot of these car makers, you get a mobile app with your car. So, you know, some family members of mine just recently bought a brand new Audi, and they have a mobile app with their car that allows them to remotely start and stop it, lock and unlock your car doors. It was funny. Some friends came over, and he actually got locked out of his car, and he was trying to break into his car to get his keys out. And it was like, just sitting there dumbfounded, like, it's 2021. Are you really trying to break into your own car? Like, where's your mobile app? How is this even possible that your car lets you lock your keys in the car? And of course it was like a 1997, you know, Honda. Or something. Oh. Anyway, but you know, it's just, you know, technology has come so far. You know, we're creatures of comfort and convenience now. And, you know, Gen Zers and millennials, the expectations around connectivity and things being always on. And, you know, all of these devices, the fabric, the underbelly of all of it is APIs. And I actually recently got a new book contract with Wiley to publish a new book on hacking APIs. So that's where I'm working on at the moment as an outline for that book. So definitely expect that soon. But
fabulous.
Yeah. That's been a lot of my research and focus is API security at Knight Inc. I'm a content marketer and content creator. So I work with cybersecurity vendors to create content around their API security products and really any product. But you know, that's been a focus of mine recently is focusing on the API security space.
Well, you're going to have work for a long time, I think.
Oh, yeah.
A long time. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I guess my next question would be, we've seen a lot of uptick in cyber attacks lately. And I have several podcasts. One of them is called Cybercrime. You can check that out, folks, on Spotify. And every day we kind of report on the different hacks that are going on. And it's, I see little patterns, right? Like everything in life, we see upticks and ebbs and flows. And I just recently, in the last month, I've seen a huge uptick again. Are any of these things concerning to you?
Sure. I mean, every breach is concerning, right? So, you know, I think more recently with this gas pipeline breach that occurred, we're now starting to see, and we've talked about it for over a decade, right? The vulnerability in attack surface with OT or operational technology. It's a real concern. It's a real problem. Flat networks around OT companies, for example, if an employee workstation gets compromised and infected with ransomware, that ransomware should not be able to jump over or affect OT equipment or SCADA equipment, supervisor control advisory. I can't remember the acronym. Too many acronyms. I live in a world of acronyms. But you know, SCADA equipment, OT equipment, it's scary. You know, it shouldn't be possible, but we're in a more connected world now. And you know, like with this gas company and being responsible for providing fuel to the eastern half of the United States, it's down right now. They can't provide fuel to the East Coast over this pipeline because of ransomware. And we're now beginning to see a convergence of these two worlds where, you know, before a company's website would get defaced or their email would get compromised, you know, something that affects data. Now we're seeing cyber attacks actually affecting human life and safety and the way we live, right? I mean, there's, you know, gas prices are skyrocketing on the East Coast, you know, so there's real impact being felt from a cyber attack. And that's the world we live in today.
Yeah, they're going, that's the scary thing is the infrastructure, right? And you got the electric grid and things of that nature. They're really concerned people. Do you think, because you have obviously international experience, do you think that the governments out there are keeping up, or are they falling behind? Are they catching up? What do you think?
I don't know if anyone has ever kept up. I don't, you know, I don't know. I think that's, you know, to me, it's kind of loaded, right? Because if you think about it's impossible to stay ahead of the adversary, right? We have to get it right as defenders 100% of the time. And adversaries only need to get it right once, right? It's they're unfair odds. So, you know, the fact of the matter is, you know, and then you want to, and then that brings up the question of a zero sum game. But, you know, the thing is that I don't think we can keep up. I think what we're always going to be doing is reacting, unfortunately, you know, is we catch up with them and we figure out how to detect a specific attack or what tactics, techniques, or procedures they're using now. When we're at a point now where we've figured it out and we've detected it and we can respond to it, they're already working on the next TTP. You know, they're working on that next tactic or technique. And so it's a constant game of cat and mouse and leapfrog. And I don't think we're ever ahead of them. You know, they're the ones really, dare I say, they're the ones who are setting the rules.
And I guess it's also complicated with certain countries that protect these individuals or just won't really do much to get them in certain countries. Is that true too? You see that?
Yeah. I'd be remiss if I didn't say that, you know, hey, look, this gas pipeline thing isn't the first real world scenario where cyber has affected human life and safety. If you recall Stuxnet, right? That was clearly, and evidence has been published, been documentaries around this. This was intelligence agencies. This was a state-sponsored coordinated attack, right? It affected life and safety. It affected, you know, nuclear power plants in a certain Middle Eastern country. There have been instances like electrical power grids that were related to ransomware outages. So, you know, this has happened before, but I don't think it's ever been published as happening in the United States. So this is very interesting. It's definitely getting interesting. Are foreign governments better prepared, or are they prepared? I don't, like I said, I don't think any of them are. I don't think any of them can be. I think we just try our best, right? Because I mean, think about it. As a CISO, my job in addition to keeping the organization secure, is a lot of the other administrivia and bureaucracy and politics that goes with being an officer at a company. You're not only working through budgets and line items and dealing with policies and procedures and trying to secure the human and developing and architecting and operationalizing an information security program. While I'm doing all that, there's an adversary or a group of adversaries out there doing nothing but spending 24 hours a day trying to figure out how to break into my network. It's unfair odds. It's unfair odds. There's just no way that anyone could spend 24 hours a day thinking up that next TTP or, you know, trying to sort of defend against that constant onslaught. Because it doesn't matter how big of a budget I get. It doesn't matter how many security controls I implement. All someone needs to do is click on the wrong file attachment or click on the wrong URL. And that adversary has gotten past all of my security defenses, all of my firewalls, all of my edge protections. And that's why they say humans are the weakest link in security.
That's going to be, we're getting close. You almost segued me into my last question, which what can we do to protect ourselves? And that's one of the things you're absolutely right. That's what, every time I read any of these ransom attacks, it's always the same thing. It's always somebody who hit the email, he shouldn't have opened up.
Yeah. And I mean, it's really, and it's funny because hacking has changed so much over the last 20 years. 20 years ago, when I was doing it, you had to know how to GCC compile stuff. You had to know how to write code. You had to know how to fix code that wouldn't compile. Now it's so easy. You download crime kits that are point and click. You've got these really pretty sexy GUIs, graphical user interfaces to these exploitation tools. You have ransomware as a service, affiliate networks that operate help desks for their crime syndicates.
Oh, come on.
They do. They operate help desks. It's crazy. So they'll provide IT support to their affiliates who are members of these ransomware crime syndicates. So it's, things have definitely changed a lot, and you really don't need to understand much in order to join a ransomware affiliate, to join a crime syndicate. You don't really need to know how to even be a programmer. Things have changed a lot. What can we do? You know, it depends. If it's a security protection for your connected car, you can't drive up to a Best Buy and ask for an ECU firewall. You can't ask your automaker that you're buying that new car from, what cybersecurity control packages do you offer that I can buy? We're just not there yet. We, unfortunately, in passenger vehicles, we're at the mercy of the automaker. We're at the mercy of the train manufacturer. We're at the mercy of the, we're at the mercy of Boeing, right? So unfortunately, it's up to them to make more secure passenger transport vehicles. As far as the consumer electronics that we buy, you know, we should always look to try and see what we can control. So can we download apps from the App Store that will create a more secure experience for us on our iPhones or Android phones? A lot of the attack surface is moving to targeting us at our mobile devices. How many people do you see carrying around a laptop anymore? How many people do you even see doing anything on their tablets anymore? Everyone wants to be on their phone. And where do hackers focus their attention? They focus their attention on the biggest attack surface. The number of laptop sales are going up, while the number of cell phone sales the number of laptop sales are going down, while the number of cell phone sales are going up. It's clear and present danger. It's obvious that the attack surface is and will be moving forward going to be on your mobile phone. So things are definitely changing. I think how do we secure ourselves against it? Just got to be more vigilant. We need to be more careful about what links we click on. We need to be more careful about the files we click on. They're getting more sophisticated. Where I'm dealing with an incident response investigation right now, where after compromising the user account for the company, they're storing weaponized files in that user's account on their cloud drive and then spamming the local employees with that link to make it look more legitimate. So, I mean, they know that we are getting smarter. I love you virus was a long time ago, and things are just a lot more sophisticated now, a lot more plausible, a lot more real looking. And we just have to, we need to be better and get better and be more vigilant. Security is all everyone's responsibility, not just cybersecurity engineers.
Great, great stuff. You're absolutely right. The more I read about these cyber crime attacks, the more I'm thinking these companies have to start investing on. We get a lot of different training that we have to do every year. This would be a great training is don't open these emails. Right. Watch out and get all these tips. I mean, some companies are doing it, but I don't see it as heavy. And I think after this, and I think, what was it? You know, France, I don't know if you probably read, you probably, I know you did, but I'm sure AXA is not covering ransomware anymore or insuring it against it. I'm assuming because they had too many, but yeah. A lot of these companies got to protect themselves.
Yeah, I'm even meeting some companies where they're adopting company policies saying that the first time you click on ransomware, we'll pay your ransom the first time. But after that first offense, you're responsible for paying for your own ransoms. So they're holding the employees responsible financially if they need to work on it. Because companies provide backup solutions. Companies provide cloud drives. Like, there's no reason that somebody should be in a position where they have to recover encrypted data because they didn't back up. Backing up your data is too easy today. You know, zip drives, iOmega zip drive, those days are gone. Backing up on floppies are gone. There's too many resources at our disposal that companies make available to their employees to back up their data that no one should have to go to the company and say, I need you to pay this ransom because I was storing my files on my local hard drive and they've been encrypted. So
I forgot the name of the one. I know we're gonna wrap up here in a couple of minutes. What's the name of it? Is there a specific name for the ransomware attacks when they are going to expose? There is a name for expose something. I know Finland, they have
lock and leak. Yeah. So there's lock and leak. So a lot of the ransomware gangs like Ryuk and Revel, what they're doing is after they've compromised the network and before they encrypt it, they download it. So they'll download it. They've got your data. Then they'll encrypt it. And then they'll send a ransom letter saying, hey, if you don't pay, we're going to leak your data. Sometimes, in some instances, they'll receive payment and still leak the data. You know, organizations need to understand that they're dealing with crime syndicates here. And one of the things that we as cybersecurity practitioners are always reminding ourselves of is we are actually fighting evil, meaning that we're not just talking about hackers here. When a ransomware gang collects the millions of dollars that they're making, they use that money to fund other illicit criminal activities such as human trafficking, you know, the sex trade, the drug trade. All of those things are being funded by a lot of these funds that are going into these ransoms. So organizations need to stop paying ransoms. I am not a supporter of ransom payments. You're not even guaranteed you're going to get your data after you pay the ransom. Who's to say that these criminals aren't going to come back to you and say, oh, if you're willing to pay $1 million, then you're willing to pay $2 million. And if you look at the price of Bitcoin and Ethereum, you know, there's your reason, a lot of your reason right there for them to want to continue to get more of it. So, you know, organizations need to unfortunately deal with the outcome of getting hit by a ransomware gang and not pay the ransom and just do better moving forward and consider a loss.
Great stuff. And that cryptocurrency is becoming a big thing right now, isn't it? A lot of these cyber criminals are starting to use that a lot. Drug cartels, terrorist groups.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm a big supporter of cryptocurrency. My wife is a cryptocurrency trader. I trade cryptocurrency. But, you know, I mean, there's definitely legitimate uses of it over, you know, I mean, if you think about it, fiat currency or currency that's backed by gold or, you know, some sort of other value. That the country states as value that can be used for illicit purposes as well, right? So, and I don't think that the villain is cryptocurrency itself. I think it's the people that are using it.
Great stuff. Great stuff. Again, folks, Alyssa Knight, KNIGHT.com. So you can find her. You can find her company at Knight Inc. Media. That's KNIGHTINKMEDIA for those listening on the podcast. By the way, if you want to see it, you can catch it on our YouTube channel. It'll be up next week. Fabulous stuff, Alyssa. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, Dr. Carlos. I appreciate it. It's been fun. Thank you for having me as a guest on your show. Look forward to coming back.
Thank you for your patience with me, too, as I try to figure out this world. You know, Alyssa, you're working on another book, but we have no clue when it's coming out yet, I don't think.
No, right now I'm working on the outline. I'm also working on a screenplay. So, there's a lot going on in my world at the moment. But, yeah, it's there's definitely some really exciting things coming. So if you're a follower of mine or if you're not a follower yet, definitely follow me on LinkedIn, Twitter. Subscribe to my YouTube channel, like my videos, and support my content. It allows me to continue to create great content, and appreciate everyone that is a fan and following my content, because there's some really cool things coming.
Wonderful. Absolutely, folks. So make sure you catch her. She's on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Make sure to share and subscribe. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Thank you.